Scaffold is supported by the Architecture Foundation, bringing new voices to the conversation about architecture in London and around the world. For more information and upcoming events, visit architecturefoundation.org.uk. From the Architecture Foundation, I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and you're listening to Scaffold. Late last month, February 2024, I was in Barcelona with my teaching partner, Kathy Hawley, and our students from the RCA, visiting projects that, in different ways, related to the theme of our studio this year, which is all about excess, or to borrow a phrase from the anthropologist Anna Singh, a new art of living on a damaged planet. Barcelona is full of architectural exuberance. Think Gaudí and Jujol, Enric Miralles and Flores Prats, all of them, and many more, designing buildings that are florid and idiosyncratic. But interestingly, by often repurposing and reorganizing existing materials and building elements, offering an aesthetic of abundance that could conceivably persist in times of profound precarity. On the other hand, there are practices in Barcelona that have a much more ambivalent relationship to the excesses of form and style, prioritizing instead a social richness that can unfold within buildings that are often necessarily more uniform and standardized. A project of this kind we visited was the cooperative housing scheme Laborda, built in 2018 by the practice Lacal. Lacal emerged in Barcelona following the 2008 financial crisis, comprised of tens of students who were all living together in a district of the city called Sants. Faced with dire job prospects and galvanized by their research into Sants' history of workers' cooperative movements, the students began addressing common needs through cooperative structures in the most comprehensive sense, whether that be in the management of energy, the procurement and development of land, or indeed in the establishment of a cooperative architecture practice. Cristina Gamboa, a member of Lacal, gave us a tour of Laborda, and I met with her a few days later at Lacal's office, itself home to a range of cooperative organizations, to learn more about Laborda and the practice that designed it. And now, my interview with Cristina Gamboa.
I think it's something I've been noticing in students, a reluctance to design anymore, and a kind of caution around this idea of authorship. To assume too much control over a project is now kind of taboo. And I mean, this is a question very close to Lacal, which itself is an architectural collective and works with collectives to make collective work. And maybe we could start there with this question of autonomy. I mean, we're kind of jumping right into things, but to me it's somehow the most crucial question.
Yeah.
How as a collective do you find autonomy when there are so many people involved in making the work?
Yeah, well, I think autonomy, it's a word that for us connects in many levels, because in a way, for us, Lacal was a space of autonomy in a context of crisis and also like working for people without conditions, etc. No? So, and at the same time, the project that we are proposing, or we are working with Laborda, is a space where the users or the inhabitants kind of have the autonomy to control the environment, or housing environment. So in terms of the design, I think that, the space of autonomy for us, it's really linked to the moments of design in a way. I think that despite we are working with in a collective way in many levels, we like to understand as inputs, as kind of information and conditions or restrictions that you are to the design. But in the moment where we are kind of understanding how this can become an architectural kind of form, object, building, we feel that we have that autonomy, which is based on also the trust between all the members. And because at the end, the environmental consultancy or the municipality or even the user are not that involved in the moment where we are here or in a workshop, all the members discussing about the project. So,
And it's so clear, especially looking at the project we visited, Laborda, there is a formal autonomy. There's a very reduced material palette and a kind of monolithic form. It's mostly corrugated polycarbonate and timber and concrete on the base. And you have these strip windows, which remind me a bit of modernist housing, Corbusier. And then this roof, this other world on the roof, which is for conviviality for laundry. It's also a garden or a greenhouse. So there's this real singular vision of the building form, and yet a very collective, what you've referred to as co-production of the project itself. And just, I think it's helpful for a moment for me and for listeners to put this in contrast with other forms of co-production or other forms of co-design. And when we toured the building, you brought up the designer or the architect, Lucien Kroll. You also mentioned Frei Otto and his Oko House project in Berlin. And to me, these are really in opposition in a way, possibly, we could debate, to what Laborda is doing. So could you talk a bit more about these other forms of collective design and the conscious decision to move away from this, the collective appearance into something more homogeneous or singular?
Yeah, I have the feeling that for us also the collectiveness, it's present in kind of, it's kind of a manifestation of the collective with all kind of this double size or double height space, out of this multi-purpose room that it's present from the street, mm-hmm. or suddenly also kind of this kind of entrance to the park or the even the greenhouse. So we were, when we were starting to design Laborda and thinking how we were, which was our position regarding participation also of the user. And in that moment, of course, we were looking Giancarlo De Carlo, Kroll, Frei Otto. It was to understand these different levels of participation, of kind of how we can also kind of build this process. And in that moment, the ownership was really important because it was a project based on collective ownership and the right of use one flat in a specific moment of your life, but not maybe all the entire life. So we were imagining that the project is not a glove for a person, and we were following more the idea of a habraken, of a support and infill, and this idea of the infrastructure.
Did you say that word again? Habraken?
Habraken, Jean Habraken.
Oh, okay.
And the theory of the supports.
Oh, can you expand on that?
Well, basically, it was the idea that the project has the main infrastructure, which it's he called the support, and then the infills, which it was the parts of the building that can change and adapt to the specific user. So it was kind of a matter of establishing a rules. And this was something that for us was having more sense, the idea that basically you were defining this idea of a community infrastructure that then users can live in different ways from the individual perspective, but also from the collective perspective, because the needs of the community will change from the moment 1 to 75 years. No? Mm-hmm. So that's who we were imagining also the participation.
That's so interesting. So it's a kind of framework
exactly.
for all kinds of possible occupations.
Exactly.
And again, the framework or the infrastructure for the community to unfold within is becoming much more commonplace in terms of what you see in the ambitions of young architects and students. And it's exciting because it is about handing over autonomy in a way and relinquishing a certain amount of control. And I guess I remember as a student, for me, the dawning awareness of this possibility first in the work of people like Lacaton Vassal, where there's a kind of generic framework. And the beauty of the project is really only captured in its entirety once it's been lived in, and once the trappings of daily life and domesticity are on display. So when the balconies are full of stuff is when the project can really be experienced. And it feels the same with Laborda. And you're right, I mean, looking across the street at this double height space, thinly veiled by the corrugated polycarbonate, you can see evidence of play, the children's toys, and people hanging laundry and stuff like that. And so it seems like there's a kind of give and take, even formally, because to understand the project as complete is to see it kind of fully used or fully occupied, as opposed to a pristine, sterile object. But at the same time, I get the feeling that it's never actually really complete. There's some really beautiful proposals for future works to the building I wondered if we could talk more about. And one is this idea of elderly care in the building. So there's a space for a mezzanine, basically, in this double height area. what happens there in the future?
I think that probably following this idea of the kind of the main infrastructure, the support, and all this idea of the infill, basically, I think that part of those kind of common areas and common needs that will be kind of in a way ended or continued being built will be that. And I think that basically we arrive to this idea of different phases of construction because budget, restriction, because economy. But suddenly we realize also how powerful it is, in the sense that basically if you define unfinished building, then the user has also the control to intervene. And this was something important for us, because at the end, if you are you are living there and realize that your needs are not fulfilled or are not kind of there, you have the capacity to understand which are the rules to use it, to intervene. So this was something that was allowing to reduce the initial budget, but was opening the door to the change and adaptation. So this idea of deep adaptation also that we are thinking now in the cities about also kind of environmental or the reduction of construction. So if the buildings are open to this transformation, maybe are also kind of making the life of it longer. No? So in a way was opening the idea of sense of belonging and adaptation through the design and through something that was really pragmatic, no? So we had enough budget. And right now, this was more present in the common areas, as we saw in the visit. Basically, the first step was finishing the kitchen and dining room. Then we are also organizing the storage space, the laundry, and the last step, it's also this care space in the building, which also basically it's interesting because right now people, it's younger. So I would say that the oldest is around 65, 68 years old. They are totally autonomous. So also there will be future needs. So this space will be ended when all those people maybe need certain support of caring at a certain kind of, yeah, exact. Well, this is part of that. No? How through the life of the users, the life of the building will kind of change and adapt. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if we could talk now about the genesis of L'École as a practice, as a cooperative. I heard you speak in a lecture explaining that there are three students at the university who are looking at sense and projects in sense. And this is the area of the city of Barcelona we're in right now, which has a history of cooperative movements. But was the genesis really in these early student projects, and how did it move from a group of three to a group of 13 co-founders?
Well, in fact, it was a group of almost probably 10 students who were renting a space in Poble Sec, another area. And suddenly another group of students, they wanted also to kind of join. So basically in around 2008, 2009, in the last stages of the university, we rented as a student a space, and it was around 21 people. In that moment, it was also in the middle, so in the School of Barcelona, where a quite really kind of canonical, more conservative, really envisioning the idea of the Barcelona from the Olympics and the 90s, and suddenly it was kind of a crisis that it was there with a kind of old or kind of outdated model of understanding architecture and the role. And in that moment was the beginning when we had to do the final project, like the final thesis. And in that moment, from this kind of rented a space, this space of working together, because we didn't have workshops or spaces to work together in the university. So basically, from that space, based on SANS, we started to imagine if we could develop projects, the final project linked to the surrounding. And we were also applying to a kind of a new jury in the university that was accepting these real projects to be the thesis project. No? So, and this was the opportunity to three of the members start to work in Can Batlló, but also, for example, Carles, another one, to work in Lleida Cencenca, which it was this project from H Architects right now. Okay. And like almost all choose spaces in the neighborhood or in the other neighborhoods linked to where they were from. So, but basically kind of conflicts or spaces of opportunity in the city where to develop the thesis or the final project. Mm. And three of them, Lali, Arnau and Paul, choose Can Batlló as a site. And this was the beginning of the involvement of all the group in the claims, the histories, and also the beginning of the recovery of Can Batlló. But in a way, it was kind of one of the many projects in the surrounding where we were involved in that moment as students, and was the entrance to understand more about the site, the histories, the cooperative genealogies. Mm. And yeah.
Can we go trace some of those cooperative genealogies now and how they've influenced the thinking of Lacolle?
Totally. I think that we basically, for us, the neighborhood was a school. So in that moment where we were kind of thinking that it was obsolete, this model of the role of the architect, this model of the city or the management of it and the transformation, the capacity to understand more about all those genealogies was essential. So basically, the values of cooperativism linked to the roots in the territory, the self or kind of the co-responsibility, the horizontality, values from sustainability in a broader perspective, environmental or even a social sustainability, were values of cooperativism. So when we were starting to imagine how we can organize ourselves as an office, because we were many people, and also with this kind of common values, the architectural or the cooperative form was something that we in a way kind of took as from the neighborhood. And in the same time, there were sociologists, anthropologists, other kind of disciplines and people important for us researching about these genealogies. And it was a moment of crisis, so it was a project from our neighbors downstairs, which it was called the Cooperative Neighborhood. And it was in a moment where the welfare state was dismantled with all the kind of the policies in Spain during the crisis. The idea to solve collectively common needs through cooperative structures was present, mm-hmm. and it was part of those research. So the idea that we could also imagine cooperative models in the transformation of the city, in the management of the resources, in the provision of housing, or also in a work environment as Lacolle, was something that was kind of really, really influential for us.
And how does it work in practice that an architectural office is run as a cooperative? Because in my experience, having worked in practice as well, there are inherent hierarchies traditionally. There are directors, associates, project architects, intern architects, or architectural assistants, as they call them in the UK. And there is an inherent hierarchy of experience, of ability, and at the same time there is of course more to learn from younger members. So I'm just wondering, how does a architecture practice function if the power structure is lateral, or is there some, there must be some kind of hierarchy built in? How does it work?
Yeah, well, basically, I think that suddenly also all changed because we were this group of students that suddenly 14 members co-founded Lacolle 10 years ago. So basically, it's different when you start a couple and then, or one or two architects, and suddenly you start kind of having more and more people, and suddenly there is kind of a difference of information, of control, of power, as you mentioned. But suddenly, in our case, we start kind of all 14 in kind of in the same moment. No? Mm-hmm. Of course, the involvement and also the work was kind of, we were kind of not working suddenly 14 members, but the idea that you are starting from the same moment, you cannot have this typical division of responsibilities of work. So suddenly you have to organize reproductive and productive work in another way. And also this was making visible that suddenly you don't have a person that it's developing all kind of all the management work or even these categories about which is kind of the different levels of responsibility, or why drawing or doing a model is less important than being in a meeting with collaborators. I don't know. So, in a certain moment, we were kind of understanding the value of any of the works in an office, and we were trying to organize it in a cross-sectional way, so all the members are involved in different stages. So this was something that it was the way we started, because the condition, and it was making us all the time thinking about when you are aware about economy in the studio, you realize about also how a detail it embeds the economy of the construction, but also the economy of the studio. You cannot be developing, 100 hours or certain number of models, because you cannot sustain it. And I think that this vision about starting from the beginning, being aware what which amount of work we are able to do to have a decent kind of even salary. So I think it was kind of a connection between these kind of two walls, mm-hmm. about how it's how to sustain this professional working structure in parallel to the production of the architecture. That I think that was giving us many new approaches to mm-hmm. even to the design. And in terms of the kind of the practicalities, we were, of course, we could not be all involved in all the stages. So the providing us spaces of decision or collective discussion. So the idea of workshops was really important. So a couple of days per week, we had assemblies to discuss about the management or the entrance of new projects or who will be lecturing in a place or another one. But also another space during the week is this idea of the workshop, where a member was presenting a project or an initiative in different stages, and we could all kind of define the guidelines in a way. So mm-hmm. we are suddenly 13, 11, 10, 8 minds, and with different also perspectives, backgrounds, interests, discussing on a project. And this is the moment where we feel that all the members are taking part of it. And I would say that the last comment about that is also this idea of transfer of knowledge. When you have a specific power structure, there is a people who is kind of having more and more also information or knowledge. So of course, the idea how we are rotating about all the different roles, how also provide the spaces of transfer knowledge, mm-hmm. and all these are mechanisms that we were just kind of trying to implement through time. So I think that our structure and way of organizing are being changing, and it's really organic. Hmm. Adapting to the different needs and the different moments of the collective or the cooperative, I think had not been the same structure and way of operating, I would say 12 months. So we are always kind of learning by doing things, not from architecture, but also from our way of organizing in the studio.
Speaking of the transfer of knowledge, you seem to have always been at the interface of the office and the public, in terms of relaying the work and ideas of the practice of the collective or the cooperative to a wider audience. And it's necessary to have a spokesperson. It's necessary to have a singular voice communicate. You're hesitant. But I think if we were to have all the members of the collective in the room right now, this conversation would be very different, and it would probably be much longer and discordant. So can you talk more about what it means to be a spokesperson for the cooperative, and how all of this kind of multiplicity gets filtered into the voice of one person?
I think it's a really important point, and I really think that this was something that at the beginning, a couple of colleagues, Carlos and Eliseo, for example, were the ones that were really present as a voice from La Col, and they were two men. In a certain moment, the woman, we were realizing constantly here in the space that sometimes we were not aware how kind of social construct, even social dynamics, were also affecting us internally. So sometimes how we were feeling not prepared enough to let a project, or not prepared enough to be kind of one of the voices. So in a certain moment, it was important for us to give different perspectives and voices outside. And it was also a moment where we were finishing La Borda, and also I was one of the persons being more involved in the project. So I think that there is certain choreographies of moments where, based on the projects, on the topics, and even the spaces, if it's more academic or more practical. So I would say that we have been changing who it's participating and who is explaining. And we are also currently in a moment where also I think that I've been really present as a voice, and it's important to have a step backwards and also give new voices. No, so even I'm just trying also right now to invite more people to be in conversations or to be. But of course, there is also even moments, personal moments, people who are not feeling comfortable because of the language, or because of we have been in a moment of many maternity and paternity leaves. So I think that it's something just temporary in a way, and I think this is beautiful because, as you also mentioned, if my other colleagues will be here, the perspective will be different, the strengths, the important points are different. I think it's also that usually when we start a lecture, I try to say that it's one of the voices, one perspective. But we are always trying to be plural, and but this is difficult. And at the same, I think that the richness of La Colle is that suddenly, if Carlos is here, we'll give another perspective. Eliseo is here, and of course, in a conversation that would maybe make it longer, more complex. We are also have different opinions, contradictions, conflicts, which I think is the beauty of La Colle, and also which makes us more strong. But yes, the voice, it's something, and the face, it's something that we are aware about that. And it's a moment of change, maybe.
I should have come during one of your assemblies.
definitely. Yeah, you should learn Catalan.
I mean, part of the process of these kinds of conversations is to understand the individual as well. And at this point, I want to talk more about your own motivations or personal motivations for being part of this collective. And I think where I want to begin in this strand of the discussion is trying to trace back to a moment in your career or your education where your attitude towards architecture shifted. Because in the public imagination, and I'm sure in the imagination of most people uninitiated in the practice of architecture, it's a very egotistic pursuit, and it is about individual expression. And so I wonder for you if this was the case initially, and if there was some moment of realization of another way of working, or if in fact you always came into the ambition to practice architecture as a collective endeavor. How did it begin for you?
I think that this idea of understanding that we are individuals also, it's something important. So we never want that kind of this idea of the collective structure could not respect in a way the individual moments. And I think it's something really beautiful. At the end, La Colle is kind of a platform where the individual interests are also kind of shaping the collective path in a way. And this is something that even with the kind of work that we are realizing right now, because it goes from participation linked to sociology to right now understanding like all the spaces of operation in the construction realm, because Laura, for example, has been studying and working in terms of project management, construction management. For us, it's really powerful how this can be a tool for us in terms of the design. So, and also, for example, cooperative housing has been one important line, or right now, energy transition. And all this, it's linked to understanding urban challenges and also where we think that we have a kind of a major role, but also based on individual needs, which are always changing. And I think that this is something that gives motivation, because constantly we are understanding that we can imagine spaces or frameworks of work different based on individual needs. Mm-hmm. And I think that for personally, when we were involved in the process of La Borda, and we were realizing about the politics of the domestic realm in La Borda from the gender perspective in a housing project, and also, of course, the environmental, also even manifestation in terms of the project, the construction. So I think that in this tension between the feminist approach and the sustainable in the domestic, and right now we are like evolving in the urban scale. And I was working in a feminist cooperative, a cooperative which is led by a group of women, lesbian, LGBT plus, and the attitude during the process, taking care about the moments of participation, design, also about how the spaces of the co-op, but also the way that we're also facing the construction, even the relation with the surrounding, that understanding that we can even kind of span this feminist approach, not from the architecture, but also in kind of the urban scale or the architectural production, was for me kind of, really kind of not a discovery, but being aware that we have to, in a way, look it from more perspective, I don't know, from another kind of point of view. And I think that this is something that I am interested in, this idea of the transition from the design to the management of resources in the urban realm, and this idea of energy transition or feminist approaches. Well, it's where I'm just right now really kind of thinking about noise.
There's a project that Lacall have worked on or are working on in collaboration with a feminist group. It's a housing project for women. Is this the one you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
And what's it called?
La Morada.
La Morada.
Exactly.
And looking at the plan for this project, there is something different going on here, slightly. I mean, it's smaller than the others.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's more idiosyncrasy happening in the plan, especially in the catwalk or the gallery, which has a distinct geometry to it that is different from the more generic or anonymizing balconies of other projects. So there's something, to me, something funny happening there, purely aesthetically. But I just wonder, because this project seems important to you on a kind of social level, how that's translating possibly to aesthetic decisions that are being made.
Yeah, it's important. So I think precisely in the process of La Morada, it was in one hand important to let them be more aware about the instrumentality of a space historically to distribute the roles about the reproductive labor at home, for example, and also, of course, explain narrative and genealogies about the approaches of feminist architecture, of feminist scholars and women that were kind of trying to explain all that. No? And the presence of the kitchen, for example, as a space that we were allocating it in the middle. And just as a transition from the public to the common to this kind of the most important place at home, which in that sense was the kitchen, but also because the idea of the own room, it was something, and the privacy and the intimacy that they wanted for also from their bodies, but also from kind of even their sexual approach, it was important. So the idea to give a lot of intimacy as kind of the exterior level of the project, and also this allocation of the kitchen in the middle was something important. And suddenly it was the corridor. And when we were also designing, they were also talking a lot about the norm and also how architecture can be really normative. And in that sense, the idea of just kind of this liberation of giving certain kind of shapes, form, aesthetics was really, really important from all the process. Even right now with the color of the facade or the appearance to the neighborhood of the project. And it was totally like this. And they were constantly, the discussions with them, that were kind of flooring or letting us know about all these kind of micropolitics in any decision. And I would say that exactly the different forms of the inner courtyard, the color, a way that we define the facade, because suddenly in a certain moment we're trying to imagine a really kind of neutral, which is a word that they hated also, mm-hmm. no? Kind of neutral facade. And it was a moment to say, look how is the neighborhood, it's a really popular neighborhood, being built through self-construction with migrant workers. They are arriving there, they are really aware to not gentrifying, to be understanding the also kind of the existing networks, but even with the presence of the building and understanding that they want to be really in touch with all those precedents and putting the value on that. It's a way that we are also understanding the role of the facade, how we kind of showing the projects or relating the project with certain architecture or the precedents or the current and contemporary, no? So I would say that constantly there is all these kind of decisions, but sometimes maybe are looking as aesthetics and for them are really political, no?
Yeah. I mean, just looking at that balcony in plan, I was thinking to myself, that is a queer balcony. But at the same time, there's a lot of very florid, very outlandish architecture in the city, historically as well, to draw from. And just moving through Barcelona with students over the past few days and looking at people like Gaudí and Jujol, or even Flores Prats, there's an overwhelming embrace of the expressivity of architecture. And I'm interested how you relate to this history, given this, up until this certain moment, this interest in neutrality in the work you're doing.
Yeah, I think it's difficult for me to give an answer to that question, because constantly we are discussing about the aesthetics or beauty, if it's something that which is maybe unnecessary. So this idea that we are constantly fighting with budget, trying to arrive to the which is absolutely necessary, which is the basis, and this is something that we understand that basically, because if we take all the layerings, suddenly there is kind of the pure architecture, it's there, and we are linking always through something pragmatic, as I was saying, as such an economy, no? So when we are imagining certain of ornamentation, decoration, or something that maybe it's more aesthetic, we think that we are excessive on that, no? And we are critical about that. Oh. And well, it's something that probably each of the members will have a different opinion. Mm-hmm. Some of them feel more or less comfortable, but suddenly, and it was a moment where a critique was saying that La Borda is ugly. And this idea of ugliness or beauty was something that we really enjoyed that critique. We were thinking, we are fine having done an ugly building. And I think that sometimes we feel more comfortable being in comparison with when L'Eixample was built by or without architect. Mm-hmm. It was this idea of the head of construction, someone who was practical, understanding the techniques, the resources, and building. And sometimes one floor plan was used for different kind of plots. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of homogeneity, or not homogeneity, but even genericness, it was something that we were feeling sometimes more comfortable, but maybe because a lack of a specific narrative through aesthetics, no? So
just, you mentioned the L'Eixample. Can you talk more for listeners who won't be familiar with what that is?
Oh, basically it's like Cerdà. So Cerdà, this extension, this major extension of the city, what nowadays is the main singularity in a way. So this was a moment where basically kind of the developers were kind of building it, no? And sometimes linked to speculative reasons, also as a way of where the resources and the colonialism in a way was being present, because it was resources being won in the colonies, been building the city. And in that moment it was two kind of architecture, the ones linked to Gaudí and all those kind of big figures, really as a representation of the power in the city, but then also these anonymous buildings of housing, which were kind of following the same typology, linked to resources, which the stones were from Montjuic, and it was this that like the memories or texts where is this description where the materials come from, and this idea of the head of the construction, who was the person in charge of this building, it's something that I would say that we feel more familiar, no? Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's a current discussion in Lacolle, no? How we, which is our position regarding all those topics and which kind of aesthetics we are looking for, and if it's a desire or a goal or something that we look for, or sometimes it's basically the outcome of a process of discussing other topics. Mm. So I think it's something that we have to address, probably. Mm-hmm.
I think there's still more of this kind of personal genealogy I'm interested in trying to understand. You talk about this experience working on La Morada with this group of women as being a kind of a moment of discovery for you personally as an architect, in terms of this relationship between aesthetics and politics, maybe, or the expressivity of a particular group of users and how that manifests on a facade or on a building form. But I think there is this really formative moment in education that must have had some kind of role in your decision to initiate or join this collective. And I'm still curious too about what your expectations for architecture were coming into education and how and when they changed. Because I suspect that this way of working and thinking probably wasn't taught, at least initially. So where do you learn that?
Well, I think that something that is important for me right now is how these different narratives are present in the schools, at least in many of the schools. And also how important is that for us to be more present in the school, to realize that there is many ways of practicing architecture. And this was something that when we were studying, it was difficult to see it. So it was a couple of teachers, Thaida Mushi was teaching at the school in that moment, Jose Maria Montaner, they were talking about the politics of architecture. It was on a seminar called Architecture and Politics. And also Thaida was the first voice that we heard about a feminist approach. And I would say that these were a couple of teachers really influential for us. They are still friends, but there were few of that. So I would say that for us, it was even when we were starting La Borda, this idea of understanding which were the main ideas and which kind of architecture we wanted to look at, which were the reference. It was a process of, in a way, self-learning, in a way, you know, trying to find that there were many precedents in the way of organizing in the studio, in the way of practicing architecture, that we never heard about them in the school. And I think that it's a pity. It's something that we have to put the value of on all those different voices, no? About, I was mentioning Kroll, Giancarlo De Carlo, but even Sergio Ferro, or many, many even women that were doing a kind of architecture that we, or Matrix, this cooperative of folks. So something that we are still discovering voices, and it's like, oh my God, why we don't know about them before, no? Mm-hmm. And this is something that it's been, it's something that we have done after. So that's why we talk about the neighborhood as a school or spaces of unlearning. And sometimes we talk about unlearning because we have learned about a specific history written by a specific white man. And this idea of understanding how we can add, complement, redraw it, and and this is also something that we are still, makes us still understand and think of this, our way of operating and of way of working. And yeah, there were not a moment of it in the school. I think it was definitely after it. Mm-hmm. And that's why we are constantly understanding that our practice, it's Each project is an opportunity of a discovery in that sense. And we are always, we are not involved in academia in a formal way. Any of the members of La Colle, it's being, for example, doing a PhD, or we are teaching, but we are teaching sometimes in a in of part of a specific courses, but not with our agenda. We are not having a course with our agenda. So each project, it's the space of opportunity of that. And it's been the way that we have been doing it. I don't know if it's correct or incorrect.
The last question has to do with this topic of evolution. It's a question about aging. When we visited La Borda, you were talking about just how much energy it took to achieve that project, which was unprecedented at the time, and I think still is in terms of being the tallest cross-laminated timber building in the city, being the first cooperative housing project developed on public land. I mean, it was a real Herculean feat. How do you sustain that energy and that ambition, and I guess that naivete as well, in a practice as the practice ages?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's the idea of aging or evolving is something that it's been really always really linked to La Colle. I would say that we are so many people that there is always kind of new energies. No, I think it's always, I've said it, like we are in a certain kind of cycles of and dynamics where there is always something that someone that right now it's maybe in a moment of just kind of resting to bring kind of new energy, you know? And I think that even this idea of evolution, it's also allowing us to think how La Colle, it's a platform for the people who founded La Colle, but also for people who are starting to work here, no? And I think one of the challenges for us, it's how the horizontality and all the discussions that we had as a co-founders, we can expand it in the new people who is involved as workers, as collaborators. So this idea of evolving the structures, the way of, and also the projects, is something that give constantly new. So we are always facing new questions and new challenges. But I think it's the how we are facing it. Mm. Yeah, it was a bit difficult for me.
It's a difficult question. I don't think I really formulated it coherently. Yeah. But maybe there is a. There's a question of when you look at most practices, they start off with very ambitious, sometimes totally outlandish work that seems almost impossible, and is only realized on the basis of this insane, naive ambition and energy that is not sustainable.
Yeah.
And over time, things become more conservative, I think, not politically or not socially, but just in terms of saving energy.
No, totally.
I guess it's a question about resisting the conservatism that corresponds with aging. And at the same time, how you sustain the radicality that's inherent to the position of youth. Because I feel like this shared accommodation, all these students living together in that moment must have been quite significant. And yet it's not the kind of conditions that older people would ever find themselves in. And so you kind of need this cooperative environment in order to foment these radical ideas. But at some point, you leave that environment. So how do you sustain that attitude despite growing older?
I think this idea of the attitude that we were thinking with the manifesto, it's interesting because one day per year, it's called we call it La Colle's Day. It's a day where we left the office and we try to visit or even construction site that we are all, but also reference of architecture and people. And the last year, we visit Kiku Rius, who did a fantastic housing building in the 70s, mm-hmm. and also then Alfonso Soldevila. So both of them were around 80s, mm-hmm. and they did two masterpieces, not really known, but when we were there, it was like, oh my God, they are so young in the way that they are thinking. And it's precisely this idea of radicality in the ideas that they had is something that we have really present. We can continue thinking constantly, like challenging the frameworks, and not this idea of even uncomfortability, like to challenge comfort in many senses, no? And I think that it's something that, because we are so many people, we have always this idea of contradictions embedded in the EDN of Lacan. Mm-hmm. So there is no assembly where someone suddenly said kind of a really addresses a conflict in a way, no? Or suddenly says, for me, we constantly, I don't know, thinking about the labor conditions, it's something that addresses different voices. And it's constantly one person in the assembly that has a specific need and just kind of bombs the environment, no? So, well, this is something that we are always trying to have in mind, no? And I would say that the collective, it's the answer. So, never, we are always in the same mood. We are always in the same personal moment, in the same interest. And precisely this is allowing us to constantly readdress the questions that we are having on the table, no? But definitely this idea of the attitude, it was something even with Lacaton Basal. I remember being in La Borda, and Jean-Philippe said, when we were doing the Palais de Tokyo, the idea of challenging the fire regulations and testing it, because it was insane what they were asking us. And suddenly we were in La Borda, and he said, like, of course there is similarities, but for me the main similarity is this attitude, facing, like, challenging ownership, challenging the parking regulation, challenging many things. So, well, this is something that we are caring about it, no? And we will always trying to give us those spaces of a stop, gather together and thinking, which is the next step, no? Well, this is... the last questions were a bit difficult, sorry. Sorry about that.
No, that was great. Christina, thank you again so much for your time.
No, to you.
You've been listening to Scaffold. If you didn't catch all the references Christina mentioned, including Francisco Luis and Alphonse Soldevila, they're all listed in the show notes of this episode. And some of the projects will be posted on the podcast's Instagram feed as well. Scaffold is an Architecture Foundation production. I'm Matthew Blunderfield, and I make this show. The theme music is composed and performed by Luke Blair. Subscribe to Scaffold on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at @scaffold_podcast. If you like the show, spread the word and leave a rating on iTunes while you're at it. Thanks to Christina Gamboa. Special thanks this week to Guillermo Fernandez Abascal. Thanks as always to Scandalin, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you next time.